is Americana. The perfidious beauty, the traitor, and the spy, they are immortal, but not for evil alone. Their names have gone down in history because Peggy Shippen was once fair and innocent, because John Andre possessed nobility, because Benedict Arnold flamed for a while a hero. Pure villainy lies forgotten while we mourn a broken sword, tarnished honor, the glory that descended.
The words you have just heard were written by James Thomas Flexner in his recent biography, The Traitor and the Spy. This program is Americana, the 21st in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you A Study in Villainy.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. One day, when I have an hour or so free to spend in the library, I hope to run down a quotation I saw recently, attributed, I think, to Charles Mertz. It went something like this: "Nothing draws a nation so closely together as its murders." Mertz meant, of course, all those great villainies of which murder is the most commonplace and most meaningful. He meant, too, not the deeds in themselves, but the deeds as they come into public knowledge, as they are reported in newspapers, magazines, books, on radio and television. Now, why so outrageous a statement as this? Nothing draws a nation so closely together as its murders. Mertz explains, as I understand him, that all reports of gross villainy give us a kind of stone against which to test the edge of public morality. I can give you an example of this. Somewhere around a year and a half ago, following approximately upon the Kefauver hearings, a book called Mafia was published by a newspaper reporter named Ed Reed. Mafia is an exceedingly sensational account of the operations of the Sicilian Black Hand Society in the United States. The following account of the death of Alfonso Palazzola, one of the original mafiosi, is fairly typical of its content.
There was a bright morning sun shining at the intersection of 10th and Wash Streets in St. Louis on September 9th, 1927. People strolled along the shade on the east side of 10th. Some entered an Italian statuary concern on the northeast corner, and one or two went into the office of a corn sugar company next door. From a nearby pool room came the click of ivory balls on the table and the sound of laughter. A Chrysler Roadster came to a stop across the street, and a tall, well-dressed, slim man alighted. He wore a white-brimmed white hat, the trademark of the mafiosi. The atmosphere of the area became suddenly tense. Passers-by nudged one another. One said to a child,
"It is Mr. Alphonse. He wears the white hat. You must bow when you speak to him."
The one who wore the white hat crossed 10th Street and stood in the doorway of the sugar company. He appeared to be waiting for someone. Gradually, his presence ceased to attract attention. Business resumed and laughter was heard. Like a country meadow after a hawk has settled in a nearby tree and appears to be merely resting, not hungry. The click of the balls on the pool tables again became audible. Few noticed a stout, rather short and swarthy man who walked north on 10th from Carr Street. It was Pasquale Santino.
"Buongiorno, Mr. Alphonse,"
he said, bowing and smiling.
"Good morning, Santino," said Alphonse. "Say, I can't give you fellows that money. I can't afford it."
"Oh, yes, sir, you can," Alphonse replied easily.
No, I can't. And what's more, I've got friends who will see that I don't have to pay it."
"We're running this town. You've got to pay," Alphonse declared.
"All right,"
said Santino meekly.
"I'll get the money and I'll bring it to you tomorrow. Goodbye, Mr. Alphonse."
He put a sinister inflection on the mister, but Alphonse didn't notice it. Alphonse was looking north along 10th Street toward the police station less than a block away. Santino was looking south. He saw a lot more than Alphonse. He saw four men run toward them across the street. Three of them jerked automatic pistols from their pockets, and the fourth produced a sawed-off shotgun. Santino had lived up to his promise. He had put the finger on Mr. Alphonse. He was less than 6 feet away from Alphonse when three pistols roared a minor accompaniment to the sawed-off shotgun. Alphonse staggered and was dying as he reached instinctively for his pistol. Then the coup de grace was given by two more assassins who drove up in an automobile and slowly and methodically emptied their pistols out of the car windows at and into Alphonse. Alphonse, the mafioso, sent one bullet zinging aimlessly into the air, then rolled over in the gutter, looking up at the alien American sky, and lay still.
Now, why should such a record of violence and savagery as this be published? Or more to the point, why should it be read by some thousands of citizens who have, in their ordinary course of existence, no connection at all with murders or with murder, and much less with that highly specialized group of savages who have been members of the Mafia? May we explain this phenomenon in the terms of Charles Mertz and say that we do not know virtue unless we also know the corresponding sin? When I had reached this point in my speculations, I happened to think of one of my favorite books, really one of the great literary classics of our time, Rebecca West's Black Lamb and Gray Falcon. In the prologue to her book, Mrs. West tells how she was in the year 1934 recuperating from an operation when she happened to turn on the radio.
But one evening, I turned the wrong knob and found music of a kind other than I sought. The music that is above Earth, that lives in the thunderclouds and rolls in human ears, and sometimes deafens them without betraying the path of its melodic line. I heard the announcer relate how the King of Yugoslavia had been assassinated in the streets of Marseille that morning. We had passed into another phase of the mystery we are enacting here on Earth, and I knew that it might be agonizing. The rags and tags of knowledge that we all have about us told me what foreign power had done this thing. It appeared to me inevitable that war must follow, and indeed it must have done, had not the Yugoslavian government exercised an iron control on its population then and thereafter, and abstained from the smallest provocative action against its enemies. So I imagined myself widowed and childless, which was another instance of the archaic outlook of the unconscious, for I knew that in the next war, we women would have scarcely any need to fear bereavement, since air raids, unpreceded by declaration of war, would send us and our loved ones to the next world in the breechless unity of scrambled eggs. That thought did not occur then to me, for I rang for my nurse, and when she came, I cried, "Switch on the telephone. I must speak to my husband at once. A most terrible thing has happened. The King of Yugoslavia has been assassinated." "Oh, dear," she replied. "Did you know him?" "No," I said. "Then why," she asked, "why do you think it's so terrible?" Her question made me remember that the word idiot comes from a Greek root meaning private person. Idiocy is the female defect. Intent on their private lives, women follow their fate through a darkness deep as that cast by malformed cells in the brain. It is no worse than the male defect, which is lunacy. Men are so obsessed by public affairs that they see the world by moonlight, which shows the outlines of every object, but not the details indicative of their nature. I said, "Well, you know, assassinations lead to other things." "Do they?" she asked. "Do they not?" I said. For when I came back to look on it, my life had been punctuated by the slaughter of royalty, by the shouting of newsboys who had run down the streets to tell me that someone had used a lethal weapon to turn over a new leaf in the book of history.
Down in St. Louis, at 12th and Carr, Big Bill Brady was attending bar. In came Duncan with a star on his chest. Duncan says, "Brady, you're under arrest." "Brady, why didn't you run? Brady, you should have run. Brady, why didn't you run when you seen Big Duncan with his Gatling gun?" Duncan and his brother were playing pool when Brady came in just acting a fool. Duncan shot him once, he shot him twice, saying, I don't make my living shooting dice. Brady, why didn't you run? Brady, you should have run. Brady, why didn't you run when you seen Big Duncan with his Gatling gun? Well, Brady went to hell looking mighty curious. Devil says, where are you from? East St. Louis. Well, take off your coat and step right this way. I've been expecting you every day. Brady, where are you at? Brady, oh, where are you at? Brady, where are you at? Strutting in hell with my Stetson hat.
We have only a few expedients when we're faced with the phenomena of violence. One of these is exemplified in the song Brady. We can set the gunfire to music, distort the action until it achieves the quality of myth, and so make a kind of entertainment out of the whole thing. Or we can move the savagery and the violence into the remote past, which is now dead and done for. I thought of this latter possibility as I was reading Robert M. Coates' History of the Land Pirates of the Natchez Trace, a book called The Outlaw Years. In this book, Mr. Coates tells the story of some of the most fearful, the most horrifying brutes ever to appear in American history. Listen to this account of the Harp brothers, Big Harp and Little Harp, homicidal maniacs, robbers, and pirates.
On an April day in the year 1797, a young circuit rider of the Methodist Church was jogging westward along the Wilderness Road. It was spring. The air was heavy with the pale scent of flowers and sleepy with the sound of the wild bee blundering among the lazily unfolding petals. The young preacher, his name was William Lambeth, rode slowly. He was thinking perhaps of the sermon he was to deliver at the next settlement. His meditations were suddenly interrupted. His horse shied, startled. Lambeth looked up. The man stood, rifle in hand, barring his path. Stand where you be, the man commanded. The stranger was tall, broad-built, apparently toward middle age. His skin was dark, almost swarthy. It had a peculiar, dried and lifeless look. His eyes had the flat, fixed stare of an animal. He was dressed like an Indian in fringed buckskin breeches and a ragged leather shirt. He didn't move for a moment. Unemotionally, he observed the preacher's agitation. Then another man, somewhat shorter and less ill-favored, stepped from the thicket. He took Lambeth's horse. They took his pistol from the saddle holster. They turned his pockets inside out, taking what silver they contained. Last, they took his Bible and fingered through the pages. Occasionally, travelers would carry paper money pressed between the pages of the book. Throughout the search, neither of the two men had spoken. Now the big man flipped the book open at its title page. On it was written the owner's name, also the name of George Washington. At this, the big man offered a strange comment. He said, "That's a brave and good man, but a mighty rebel against the king." Now two women appeared, coming silently, both ragged and unkempt. And this seemed a signal. The men bundled their booty together, Lambeth watching helplessly as they seized the horse by the bridle and made off into the forest. As they went, they entered the thicket and both turned abruptly. "We are the Harps!" they shouted, and then plunged out of sight. It had been a strange visitation. Not the fact of the robbery had been surprising. Brigandage was already frequent along that barren way, but this one lacked all purpose. Preachers were always poor. The holdup had not repaid its risk. Yet the robbers had seemed neither surprised nor angered. All their actions had been erratic, as if half-controlled.
They had been like men throbbing with a strange fury. They had been like madmen. This was the first known crime of the Harps. It was also almost the only one that did not end in murder.
Mr. Coates' introduction of the Harp brothers is, I must say, very handsomely justified by his account of their career. To call them beasts of prey gives no adequate notion of what they were like. They appear to have been driven by some unnameable, indescribable fury to destroy life without the slightest regret or discrimination.
Was on a Christmas morning, the hour was about 10, when Stack Lee shot Billy Lyons and landed in the Jefferson pen. That bad man, cruel Stack Lee. Messenger came to the window, then he knocked on the door, and he said, "Your old man's lying there, dead on the barroom floor." That bad man, cruel Stack Lee. Then Billy Lyons' old woman had something to say. "Stackley, oh Stackley, what have you gone and done? You've gone and shot my husband with a 44 Gatlin gun. Oh Lordy, cruel Stackley." Stackley's friend had something to say too. "Stackley, oh Stackley, why don't you cut and run? For here comes a policeman, and I think he's got a gun. Oh, Lordy, poor Stackley." Now, this here is Stackley talking in jail. "Jailer, oh, jailer, I just can't sleep, for the ghost of Billy Lyons round my bed does mourn and weep. Oh, Lordy, won't you help Stackley?" Now, we hear from the counsel for the defense. "Gentlemen of this jury, you must let poor Stackley go. His poor and aged mammy is lying very low. Oh, Lordy, poor Stackley." Now the counsel for the prosecution. "Gentlemen of this jury, wipe away your tears. Poor Stackley's aged mammy has been dead these 11 years. That bad man, cruel Stackley."
Another expedient, the glorification of violence. In the old ballad, Stackley, which you just heard, we have the murderer elevated to the status of hero. And this, of course, is true of all the bad men ballads that have ever been invented. By such means, both devious and direct, do we test our lives and our virtue against the realities of violence. For this is one sort of crime which we choose almost automatically as a test, a kind of yardstick of evil. There is another kind of villainy which in the present day becomes of greater and greater general concern. This is the offense of treason. I suppose that for a good many years, until perhaps the last 3 or 4 decades, treason in the realm of villainous acts has seemed to us like Milton's Satan in the realm of villainous creatures, august, terrible, and remote. But we have now lived for some time in a world in which treason occurs. We see it as a peculiarly horrifying crime, and yet are, I suppose, puzzled by it in a sense. It's far more difficult to recognize an act of treason than it is to recognize an act of murder. So much depends on the point of view from which the act is seen. Lacking Yorktown, General Washington might have been hanged as a traitor instead of being exalted as a hero. With a somewhat different turn of events, Benedict Arnold might almost have taken Washington's place in history. Of course, the very archetype, the pattern of traitors to Americans, is Benedict Arnold. A recent biography, The Traitor and the Spy, by James Thomas Flexner, tells the story of Arnold, his unfortunate wife Peggy Shippen, and Major John Andre. There's so little left of the truth about Benedict Arnold in our American tradition that a book like this is particularly worth reading. Most of us, I suspect, remember little of Arnold except that he tried to sell West Point to the British, and that when his plot failed, he escaped with his life, while Major John Andre, his fellow conspirator, was captured and hanged as a spy. Few of us, indeed, remember Arnold's real brilliance as a soldier in the revolutionary cause. If we judge by his behavior at Quebec, at Crown Point, and at Saratoga, we might very well conclude that he was one of the most distinguished combat generals of the Revolution.
Come unto me, ye heroes, and I the truth will tell, concerning many a soldier who for his country fell. Burgoyne, the king's commander, and cursed Tory crew, with Indians and Canadians, he up the Champlain flew. He up the Champlain flew. He up the Champlain flew. With Indians and Canadians, he up the Champlain flew. The 7th of October, they did capitulate. Burgoyne and his proud army, we did our prisoners make. And vain was their endeavor, our men to terrify. Though death was all around us, not one of us would fly. Not one of us would fly. Not one of us would fly. Though death was all around us, not one of us would fly. Now here's a health to Herkimer and our Commander Gates. To freedom and to Washington, whom every Tory hates. Likewise unto our Congress, God grant it long to reign. Our country rights and justice forever to maintain, forever to maintain, forever to maintain. Our country rights and justice forever to maintain.
Battle of Saratoga is a song contemporary with the Revolution, and on that account, it might be imagined to have a particular claim to belief. Most contemporary historians, however, would not agree with it. It was certainly not the fault of the Continental Congress that General Burgoyne did not win the Battle of Saratoga. And as a matter of fact, had the tactics of General Gates been carried out, Burgoyne might very well have saved his army to fight another day and perhaps to win. The outcome of the Battle of Saratoga must be attributed chiefly to Benedict Arnold, who was acting without proper authority and indeed against orders. Arnold was with Gates's army at the time of the battle, but had been allowed no troops to command. He had, in fact, been engaged chiefly in carrying on a prolonged and bitter quarrel with General Gates. At this point, the very first sound of the battle reached Gates's headquarters.
No longer able to stand still, Arnold leaped on a huge black stallion and rode about the camp, betraying great agitation and wrath. He saw Gates at ease before his headquarters, chatting with his aides, when soldiers arrived from the battle with reports Arnold ached to hear. Gates seemed hardly to listen. Finally, the commander looked in Arnold's direction. Arnold grew faint with anticipation. Surely he was needed. But Gates looked through him. Arnold rode to where ranks of troops stood nervously at arms. But when they saw Arnold sitting idly on his great horse, reproach, or so it seemed, appeared in their eyes. He opened his mouth to explain, but how could he explain? As the noise of battle augmented, there came to Arnold's nostrils the acrid smell of burned powder. He shouted, "Victory or death!" and dug his spurs into his horse's side. The powerful animal leaped out of the sallyport into the woods toward the lovely sound of battle. Gates was horrified to see Arnold disappear, certain that the unleashed warrior would upset his strategy. He commissioned Major John Armstrong to order Arnold back to his quarters. Mounting a fast horse, the major set out in pursuit. Arnold was now far ahead. On a wagon road between high trees, he met some retreating stragglers. They cheered and followed him back toward the enemy. Soon he was surrounded with the familiar faces of Learned's brigade, drawn up along a stream that marked a break in the forest. In the clearing beyond, Arnold saw a gentle rise, and on the top, tight-packed Hessians, knee-deep in wheat, their guns at rest, but all their faces turned toward him. The grain rippled in the breeze, and the sun glistened on helmets. This was the center of the British line. Since the Hessians stood in open ground suited to mass firing, they had not been attacked. Hardly pausing in his gallop, Arnold urged his horse over the stream and up the exposed slope. He shouted, "Come on, brave boys, come on!" The troops had been hesitating before the deadly task, but they followed him. When the Hessian line fired, Arnold hardly noticed it in his exaltation. Then he realized that he was advancing alone. The charge had broken.
Arnold rallied his men and in a second charge cracked the Hessian line. Again and again he gathered the scattered American troops and led them in new attacks, always successfully. And at last he led a charge on a redoubt which flanked the British position.
The left and rear of the redoubt and the extreme British right were now exposed. Shouting to the troops nearest him, Arnold galloped into a clearing which rose toward the ramparts. The troops answered his shout and followed him. Some cannon rattled grape around them, but musket fire from the ramparts was slack, since most of the garrison had gone out to the battle and none had returned. Arnold led his men to the rear where the walls were less high. As he reined in, the foot soldiers went over the wall. The portal shook as if it were about to be opened. But before Arnold could reach it, his horse gave a convulsive leap and fell dead. Arnold was thrown at full length, and when he started to rise, his leg, which had been wounded at Quebec, crumpled beneath him. As he writhed on the ground, fighting the pain and the helplessness, a shadow fell upon him. Major Armstrong delivered Gates's order that he return to his quarters. Darkness now brought an end to the battle. Since the capture of the redoubt had outflanked the entire British position, Burgoyne would have to withdraw. He was soon to surrender. Arnold had struck a tremendous blow for the American cause, but now he was surrounded by an army of doctors. He was never again to bear arms for the United States.
This was Arnold's greatest moment, the last of his great moments. Crippled, harassed by the Congress and by his military enemies, threatened with court-martial, he at length determined to turn his coat and join the British. The end of Arnold's story was neither tragic in the grand sense nor heroic. It's a great pity, I sometimes think, that men who find themselves unable to live well and happily cannot depend at least on some sort of final tragedy to dignify their lives. For a man of Arnold's real ability and genuine humanity, his flight and subsequent futile attempts to recoup his fortunes perhaps constitute a more ignoble ending to his story than he deserved. Yet anyone who reads Flexner's biography will conclude at last that we are right in regarding Arnold as a villain and in being fascinated by his villainy.
The perfidious beauty, the traitor, and the spy, they are immortal, but not for evil alone. Their names have gone down in history because Peggy Shippen was once fair and innocent, because John André possessed nobility, because Benedict Arnold flamed for a while a hero. Pure villainy lies forgotten, while we mourn a broken sword, tarnished honor, the glory that descended.
You have been listening to Americana, the 21st in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Songs and ballads are by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Wynn Strachey. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Griskin. The books mentioned on tonight's program were Rebecca West's Black Lamb and Gray Falcon, published by the Viking Press, Robert M. Coates' The Outlaw Years, published by Pennant Books, Ed Reed's Mafia, published by Random House, and James Thomas Flexner's The Traitor and the Spy, published by Harcourt Brace and Company. If you wish to receive a list of the books mentioned on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network.